for around £50 billion. A man has been arrested by police investigating the murder of a primary school teacher, Aisling Murphy, in Ireland. Tonga has described the volcanic eruption and tsunami, which hit the Pacific Island nation on Saturday, as an unprecedented disaster. BBC News.
And the news was read by Jane Steele. Humour can often be found in the bleakest of times, and the PC-turned-comic Alfie Moore will share one such occasion next tonight here on Radio 4, after a lush and verdant look ahead to the weekend.
On BBC One.
Welcome to a world where a life can last thousands of years. Where there is ingenuity unlike anything we've ever seen. Where beauty knows no bounds. The incredible world of plants.
The Green Planet with David Attenborough.
Welcome to their world.
On Sunday at 7 on BBC One and iPlayer.
Alice will cause concern in the Archers in half an hour here on Radio 4. Before that, the ethical dilemmas of dealing with an attempted suicide are an unlikely source of humour, as the policeman-turned-stand-up comedian Alfie Moore tells true stories from his career in It's a Fair Cop.
That's the sound that I need. That's the sound that I police. That's the sound that I need.
Hello, my name is Alfie Moore, and welcome to It's a Fair Cop. The show where you, the audience, are sworn in to face the same policing dilemmas that I faced in today's real case. I'm here to offer professional guidance as an experienced police sergeant and also a stand-up comedian. Both jobs have seen me dealing with a similar number of drunken dullards. The main difference in stand-up, I'm allowed to tell the drunken dullards. They are, in fact, drunken dullards. However, as a police officer, I have to call them sir. But I can taser them. This week, our focus is on decision-making. The office of constable brings with it power and authority, but also great responsibility. You have to be decisive. And sometimes, just like my CSE maths result, there are no right answers. Decision-making is often easier with a good partner to bounce ideas off. Think of all the successful TV crime-fighting partnerships, Starsky & Hutch, Cagney & Lacey, Batman & Robin, Richard & Judy. Sorry, that's stupid. Not Batman & Robin. There's always some dramatic backstory how they got together, the partnerships. Let me tell you how we do it in Humberside. It's Friday night. The beginning of a week of night shifts, and the duty sergeant is briefing us. Time for the big moment. He's about to tell us who we'll be working with. The tension builds. Pete, you're with Jonesy. Tracy, you're with Simo. Alfie, you're Tango Bravo 03 with Reg. Oh, no! Not Reg! Reg is a bit beige. A stickler for procedure. His catchphrase is, ooh, I'm not sure about that. So that's it. I'm stuck with Reg on nights all week, and we were faced with a real case that pushed my decision-making to the limits. Before we go there, let's look at some of your audience answers when we asked, have you ever worked with somebody that you didn't like? This first one is from somebody called Gordon Brown. Thank you, Gordon. So, oh, by coincidence, have you ever worked with someone you don't like? I used to work with Michael Gove. Go figure. Have you worked with somebody you don't like? I used to work in a very confined space operating and maintaining complex machinery. One of my team had very, very smelly armpits, big and stinky. I promoted him so he'd be in charge of the night shift. That's from Ian. OK, well done, Ian. OK. Now, we try to avoid easy stereotypes on this show, but Nick has just answered it naturally. I worked in France. Thanks, Daph. Thank you. Have you ever worked with someone you didn't like? I worked in nuclear decommissioning as an engineer. I was working on the UK's long-term geological waste storage. Our design life was over 100,000 years. My manager was a strict Christian who believed the earth was only 5,000 years old. And he kept deleting the reference on all my reports that disagreed with this. In response, I started to put up Jurassic Park and other dinosaur evolution-related posters. He wasn't happy. Okay. That's fabulous, yeah. Ever had to work with somebody you didn't like? I was on about 6 management training courses with a bloke who had done everything. We know them, don't we? And knew everything. After each course, we filled in the course feedback sheets with very unpleasant comments and then put his name on them. Until they didn't let him go on any more courses. They were great. Well done. So, it's time to swear you all in as coppers for the night. Please raise your right hands and repeat after me. Oh, just one more thing.
Oh, just one more thing.
Right, you're all officially police officers for the duration of the show. Time to begin our real case, and as soon as the night shift briefing is over, my partner Edge enthusiastically grabs the car keys, dashes over to the patrol car, and jumps into the passenger seat. Looks like I'm driving again. Later that night, Reg is just explaining to me in detail about how North Lincolnshire Council might be changing their bin collection days when I was saved by the radio.
Tango Bravo 03, we've had a call from ambulance to say they're at 46 West Haven Road in Scunthorpe after receiving a report that 22-year-old Michael Baxter may have taken an overdose of paracetamol, but he's refusing treatment. Would you like to attend?
Would I like to attend? Clearly, control isn't sure whether we should go, and I'm not sure either. What do you think, audience cops? A suspected overdose, is this something the police should deal with? Yes, you think we should be going?
Yes, it sounds like there's more to it than he won't take treatment. He's obviously possibly being a bit violent.
In fairness, they would have told us if there was any violence and they've not passed that on to us. What's your name, sorry, sir?
Nick.
Nick. My thoughts are that surely this is a medical emergency. What am I going for? I can't order him to accept treatment. Where are the no, I'm not attending? Hello, what's your name, please?
Jan. I agree with what you said. It's medical, not...
You're not going to attend because it's not your area of business.
Correct.
I do decide to go. At no point waiting for Reg to make the call, he's got the, ooh, I'm not really sure about that, written all over his face. Control from Tango Bravo 03, please show us attending the job on West Haven Road. Over. At the address, we see an ambulance, but as soon as they see us, the paramedic tells us that Michael won't confirm he's taken any tablets, has declined treatment, and seeing as the police have now arrived, they'll be off. Fell for that one, didn't I? The police and ambulance service get on great, but we sometimes play pass the person. It's like a game of pass the parcel that no one wants to win. So we all want to pass on the person before the metaphorical music stops. If I see someone too drunk to stand up, I can't just ignore that. That's now my responsibility. So I call an ambulance. They come along and have to pick him up. I've just passed the person, but they're furious. They take him to A&E. Now they're furious. But that's where the music stops. So they're stuck with the drunken guy. Until he starts getting aggressive, then they ring the police. And the parcel is returned to sender. The process has been made even more exciting since Jeremy Hunt invented a game of musical beds, in which the number of hospital beds is gradually being whittled down one by one. So back to our Scunthorpe job. It's a report of a possible overdose, but the subject, Michael, is not cooperating and ambulance have just resumed patrol. Looks like Michael's now our parcel. We're let in by Mum. She explains that she's been contacted by a cousin who was alerted by somebody else that recognised her son Michael in an online chat room announcing he'd taken an overdose. It's all a bit obscure. A mother says that she can't reason with her son, but believes he's taken an overdose of painkillers. Michael lives there alone. Reg and I go through to the living room and I introduce myself. I ask if he's okay. He says, yeah, I'm fine. Have you taken any tablets, Michael? With all due respect, officer, it's nothing to do with you, what I've taken. Are you on any prescription medication? Do you have any in the house? He politely replies, it's nothing to do with you. This has all the chattiness and frivolity of a post-match Jose Mourinho interview. I asked Michael if he'll talk to someone from the mental health team or the Samaritans. He says, no thanks, I'm fine. My mum's a bit of a drama queen, but she means well. I throw Reg a glance. He's trying to remain incognito and apparently fascinated by Michael's light fittings. Thanks, Reg. I'm thinking, what if it's mum? What if she's got issues? So far, all the info we have has come from her. Should I check mum on our police systems? Anyone got a problem with that? Check mum out? Nobody's got a problem? No? Okay. Too right. Most forces will do that automatically. For all I know, mum is a persistent caller with as much grasp of reality as Kim Kardashian. I'm passed the info on mum through my earpiece. Back in the day, we didn't have earpieces, so everything would be done via subtle codes. The police used to have a radio protocol called the 10 code. 10-1 meant commencing patrol. If you were in desperate trouble, it was considered unprofessional to shout, help! So instead, you calmly said 10-9, and everyone would know to come running for backup. 10-7 meant unclear or unreadable. And so we'd misappropriate that code to describe people's mental states. I'm with Mavis. She's a bit 10-7. The dispatcher would type on the incident log, Mavis is 10-7. We'd have a coded audit trail of our instant, unqualified mental health assessment of that individual. That would vary between a bit 10-7 and very 10-7. Occasionally completely 10-7 with a bit of 10-9. Wholly inappropriate, and many would deny it ever happened, but it did. In our defence, I would say that back then, we didn't know any better. I joined the police in 1987, and I had my first mental health training last year. 30 years later. Not good enough. Back to our real case. I've been talking to Michael for about 5 minutes, trying to establish whether or not he's taken an overdose. I get an update that neither Michael nor his mother are known to the police. I ask if there's anybody we or his mother can contact to pop round, have a chat with him. No. This is the politest no-comment interview I've ever had, and I once arrested a vicar. Who was very polite, but needed to brush up on commandment number... whichever the one is for a fraudulent tax disc. Instead of a tax disc, he'd got one of those red-coloured drink coasters with the words... all I need is Jesus. Well, technically, you also need a vehicle excise licence. Good try. Speaking of invisible entities, I look at my colleague, Reg, as I have no idea what to do next, but he's now busy studying Michael's CD collection. The radio's now asking if we can resume as there's a fight starting in the town centre. Audience cops, we're not making any progress. Is it time to leave this job? Who says no? I'm stopping. What's your name, please?
Rosanna. If he has taken a number of tablets, you'll be able to assess that if you stay with him a bit longer. And the police have the powers to convey him to a place of safety if needed.
Oh, we have the powers to convey him to a place of safety, Rosanna. OK, what do you do?
A psychologist.
OK. I suppose you think that makes you qualified.
We have these conversations with the police quite a lot.
OK, that's interesting, Rosanna. Who says, no, I'm going, I'm off to the fight? OK. What's your name, please?
Barbara.
You like a good scrap, Barbara? You're off to the fight. What's your thinking?
It's something which the police do.
What, going to fights? Attend fights, yeah, yeah. Attend fights. But what about this young man? Aren't you worried about him? It could be dying, Barbara.
Well, with paracetamol overdose, you've got to get them to a hospital eventually, but it won't be...
No rush. No rush. No rush. I'm really not sure whether to stay or go at this point. And I need to visit the bathroom for a pee and some RFR, respite from Reg. And you don't want to be going to a fight on a full bladder at my age. Hand-to-hand combat is difficult enough without having your legs crossed. Besides, one low punch and you'll pick up a new nickname for the rest of your police career. And no one wants Officer Dribble. As I walk through the kitchen to the loo, I see the kitchen bin. It's one of those tall pop-up ones. I think, should I take a look in the bin? If he's taken something, there might be a clue. Who's looking in the bin? Audience cops. What's your name, sir?
Chris. It's not that intrusive. He's not going to know whether or not you've done it.
But do you think that would be allowed? Do you think it would be classed as a search?
Not if anybody knows.
So it's... Interestingly, under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984, it would probably technically count as a search. That's why a cop will not stop your car and tell you to open the boot. Instead, they'll just casually ask what's in your boot. And then you'll open it entirely of your own volition. Meanwhile, back at our Scunthorpe case, and I flip the kitchen bin lid to discard an imaginary piece of lint from my uniform. I can see some mail on top. Okay, who's going to read the mail? Who's reading the mail? Now we're going to have to go in the bin to get the mail. Put your hands up if you're going in. Not many people are going in. I mean, there could be information in the bin that could make sense of the situation. Could be a season ticket for Scunthorpe United. There could be something revealing like financial demands, blackmail or bullying or all three combined if it's a payday loan company. I can distinctly remember looking down at the mail thinking, should I? I do have a look. It's just junk mail. But underneath, I start to find empty medication packets for paracetamol, sleeping tablets, antihistamine and other stuff that I can't even identify. I'm now starting to believe that Michael really has taken an overdose. I take Reg to one side and let him know that I've been looking in the bin, and he responds with a comforting, "Ooh, I'm not sure about that." When I tell him that I found some empty pill packets under the junk mail, Reg raises an eyebrow and queries, "Why wasn't the junk mail put in the paper recycling?" I give up on Reg. I decide a different approach. I pick up the empty packets, march into the living room and challenge Michael. He doesn't confirm or deny, but instead says, "It's nothing to do with you." I tell him that his mother is worried. She is worried. I tell him there's a fight in town. Somebody could be getting hurt and we're stuck here dealing with him. I also tell him that if he's taken those tablets, he needs urgent medical attention or it could be very serious and he may die. His mum starts to cry. I ask him if he'll engage with the ambulance. If I call them back, he says, "No, thank you." I'm trying everything, alternating between good cop, bad cop, whereas Reg is alternating between ineffective, indecisive cop and arse-covering, pension-protecting cop. Michael is not going to cooperate, so I start to consider what legal powers I have. Is it a crime to harm yourself? Can I arrest him for it? Is it a crime to try and kill yourself? What do you think, audience cops? Do you think that's a crime? It's actually not. It was decriminalised in 1961, but we are a bit behind on Radio 4. It's now just classed as a crime against God. I say just, you don't want to get the wrong side of him, really. One minute you're skipping down the road without a care in the world, the next you're a pillar of salt. But you do get a free tax disc. I consider my police powers under the Mental Health Act 1983. When you hear about people being sectioned, they're referring to one of the sections in this Act. Section 136 of the Mental Health Act gives the police power to detain someone in immediate need of care and control and remove them to a place of safety for up to 24 hours in order for them to have a mental health assessment. This was sometimes carried out in police cells. Used to be two doctors and a nurse, and it changed to one doctor and a nurse, and it changed to approved mental health professionals. Now we just get more in the cleaner to have a look through the cell hatch and say, "Yeah, he's a bit 10-7. There's a massive debate about police cells being used for this purpose. Let me tell you, it was never our preference. But the hospitals are full. What can we do? The number of mental health cases dealt with by the police in England and Wales last year was 215,000. That's a rise of more than a third in 3 years. Police cells are not the place for people with mental health issues. We can do everything we can to reduce the risk. All prisoners will be searched, belts, anything sharp that could harm them, jewellery, cords, laces removed. But people get inventive. This is a true story that I'm only telling because the person concerned was completely fine in the end. About 15 years ago, I was in the custody suite in Scunthorpe signing out a prisoner for interview. A colleague, Clarkey, went to fetch a young lady. When he opened the cell door, she had her underwear tightened around her neck in a ligature and was strangling herself. Clarkey instinctively dropped to the floor and tried to remove them, but they were very tightly fastened. He's pulling, she's going redder. Clarkey went for his radio. He hadn't got it. In the end, he screamed from down the cell block at the top of his voice, "Help! I can't get her knickers off!" Back to Michael and detaining someone under Section 136. The thing is, the use of this power is restricted to a public place. The definition of a public place has recently been widened to include garden and outbuildings, but not inside someone's private dwelling. So Michael is not in a public place. Unless, of course, we coax him outside. Then we can lawfully detain him. So who's doing that? Who's going to coax Michael outside so we can lawfully detain him and take him for an assessment? What's your name, please?
Ash.
You're going to coax him outside?
I've actually done it.
You've done it yourself, Ash, OK.
Yeah, coax somebody out. I used to be a police officer.
OK. How long were you a cop for?
4 years. I was an instructor, though.
So you trained the cops?
Yeah.
You think it was probably lawful?
Duty of care.
Duty of care? The overriding duty of care? I mean, it is difficult, isn't it? Striking a balance between proportionality, legality, safeguarding and intrusion, whilst trying not to swear at Reg. No, I certainly cannot trick Michael outside. I don't agree with you, sir. I cannot trick Michael to come outside into a public place because that's an illegal abuse of process, abuse of authority, although I'm sure it has been done many, many times. I strongly believe Michael may have taken an overdose and I feel that I need to do something urgently. So I consider, can I use the Mental Capacity Act 2005? A statutory framework for people who lack capacity to make specific decisions for themselves. Some people will experience fluctuating capacity, such as Donald Trump every time he goes on Twitter. Does anybody say, forget about the legislation? This kid could be dying. Let's do something now. OK, we've got a hand up there. OK.
He just needs some help. You're the only people around to do it.
OK.
And he may die.
So he's coming with you?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Simon.
Simon, okay, Simon. Are you worried about getting into trouble?
Not if he lives.
If he dies because you're dragging him out, it could be an issue, yeah.
No, if he dies, if you leave him behind.
Okay, if he dies, we leave him behind. Interesting. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. Simon, what do you do?
I'm a lawyer.
You're a lawyer? Okay, Simon, thank you. I tell Reg I'm going to detain Michael under the Mental Capacity Act. He pulls me aside and says, "Ooh, remember the Sese case?" Reg reminds me about two Met Bobbies that were concerned about the welfare of a lady called Ms. Sese and use her power under Section 5 of the Mental Capacity Act to take her to the mental health unit for assessment. She took the health trust and the Met Commissioner to the High Court. The judge praised the two officers for acting in her best interest just before awarding in her favour, because they used the wrong act and section. It's rumoured that the Sese case cost the Met a substantial amount of cash. That wouldn't have happened in Scunthorpe. We haven't got a substantial amount of cash. Two caring cops who deserved the highest praise, but the ruling went against them. And I know that's difficult to believe, me praising two Met Bobbies. But they deserve it. Back to Scunthorpe. And now I'm thinking that I can't assume that Michael lacks capacity just because he appears to be making an unwise decision. I'm aware that in the UK, men are three times more likely than women to take their own lives and that suicide is the single biggest cause of death of men under 45. And it's preventable. But Michael just will not engage. Talk to me, Michael. Please, talk to me. Michael responds by calmly saying, "I'd like you to leave my property now, please." Let me tell you, this is the most frustrated I have ever been as a copper, and we had Theresa May's Home Secretary for 5 years. Reg reminds me that, as Michael has asked us to leave, we have no lawful authority to remain there. I keep mentioning that word lawful, but we are police officers, and people get a tad tetchy if we break the law. I say people, sometimes they're called judges. I turn to Mum and say, "Sorry, I'm out of ideas. We need to go. I advise you to stay with Michael, and if his health starts to deteriorate, to ring the ambulance again." As I turn to go, Mum steps forward, grabs my arm. Tears start running down her cheeks, and she gives me a heart-wrenching look, saying, "Please, please help me." I look at Mum. I look at Michael. I'll tell you what happened next after your audience responses when we asked, "Have you ever made a spur-of-the-moment decision that had good or bad consequences?" Okay, this was from a gentleman who gives his name, thank you, but prefers to be anonymous, so we'll keep it that way. My granddad had a spare ticket for the 1966 World Cup final. But on the morning of the game, I heard that my idol, Jimmy Greaves, would not be playing. I cried my eyes out and refused to go. My granddad bought me a 99-flake ice cream and I went. The rest is history. Ever made a spur-of-the-moment decision that had good or bad consequences? What happened? Left Kent, returned to the Midlands, bad choice. Ever made a spur-of-the-moment decision that had good or bad consequences? Yeah, what happened? Voted Brexit, consequences, shit. So, to recap our real case. My colleague Reg and I have attended the address of a 22-year-old Michael who is suspected of having taken an overdose of medication, but refused medical treatment, won't engage with me, and is now asking us to leave, thereby withdrawing our lawful authority to be there. Reg is getting a bit windy. He does things exactly by the book, and he's tugging on my arm, saying, "We need to go. He's asked us to leave. We need to go." The radio's chirping away, asking us to resume to the drunken dullards windmilling in the town centre. I look at Mum. I look at Michael. I look at Reg. He was no help. Then I look back at Mum again, tears rolling down her cheeks, and I make my decision. I step forward and punch Michael hard in the face. Yes, I did. Knocked him to the floor. I decided he was going to hospital now. I cuff him, lead him to the police car, put him in the back seat, stuff a protesting Reg beside him. I switch on the blues and twos. Reg was in deep shock. He'd probably never seen a blue light on before. In truth, he thought I'd completely lost the plot. As I walk Michael into A&E, he collapses. They take him to the emergency room and pump his stomach. After that, he was sectioned and admitted to the mental health ward. Turns out his behaviour was triggered by a relationship ending. How lawful was his initial detention? I suspect not very. Did I care about being sued? I didn't give a jot. My primary aim is to preserve life, not to count beans. Well, thank you. Well, that's nice. I've been sacked now, but that's... Did the end justify the means? Damn right it did. Punching that innocent young man was probably the highlight of my policing career. Especially 2 weeks later when he shook my hand, looked me in the eye and thanked me for saving his life. This is me, Officer Dribble, signing off. And so until next time, look out for one another. Goodbye.
It's a Fair Cop was written and presented by Alfie Moore. The script editor